Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Coming up on the programme, more problems for the beleaguered airline manufacturer Boeing. And we're going to take you to a remote island which has only one shop. And it looked like it was going to be shut down, but in some good news, it's remaining open. And we do like to try and bring you some good news on this programme. But we're going to start by talking about the man who's in charge of the world's second largest economy, as the Chinese leader Xi Jinping has been on a state visit to France. Over the next few days here on our business programmes on the BBC World Service, we're going to talk quite a lot about his visit to Europe. It's his first since 2019, because it comes at a time of growing economic tensions between the EU and China, with concerns over dumping and subsidies over products like electric vehicles and solar panels. The European Commission head, Ursula von der Leyen, has said she's raised the issue of Chinese subsidised goods distorting those EU markets.
These subsidized products, such as the electric vehicles or, for example, steel, are flooding the European market. At the same time, China continues to massively support its manufacturing sector, and this combined with a domestic demand that is not increasing, the world cannot absorb China's surplus production.
The French President Emmanuel Macron today also urged fair rules for all in Europe-China trade. Here's a little bit of what President Xi has been saying.
The world today has entered a new period of turbulence and change. As two important forces in the world, China and the EU should remain partners, adhere to dialogue and cooperation, deepen strategic communication, enhance strategic mutual trust, build strategic consensus, and carry out strategic coordination.
Let's get some more details of what's been taking place today and some of the challenges. Elvire Fabry is a trade expert at the Jacques Delors Institute in Paris.
The EU is determined to address the problem that the state capitalism in China is creating within the single market, with some Chinese companies which have been subsidized with no limits for a long time and which are now exporting to the EU some products that have a competitive advantage, but which is not following the usual market economy rules and which are really out of the limits of the subsidies that are allowed by the WTO.
The WTO, the World Trade Organization. From a consumer's point of view, though, particularly when we're talking about competition in green areas where we need to make that transition, isn't it good that the Chinese can produce these products at such cheap prices? Couldn't Europe do the same?
It's a good thing to have access to some cheap green technologies, those technologies that the Europeans need, obviously, to accelerate the decarbonization of the European economy. But the other side of the coin is that all the European industry is confronted to that very fierce competition at a moment when China has succeeded to get a really strong leadership in the green technological sector and is now exporting its overcapacity of those green technologies that the Chinese market cannot absorb at a moment where the Chinese consumption has been lowering down. Just at the moment when the EU has set for itself some targets to increase the capacity of production of those green technologies, there's really a strong concern that we may repeat the scenario that we have been exposed to concerning the solar panels a decade ago.
Let's pick up and look at the European solar industry that Olivier mentioned there. Let's hear from someone with strong views on that. That's Dries Akke, who's the deputy CEO of Solar Power Europe.
Solar manufacturing in Europe is absolutely under pressure. We are confronted with a perfect storm of different dynamics. where China has invested significantly in upscaling its solar manufacturing capacity. But what has also happened is that European developers and installers have ordered too much solar over the last years. So together, that has reduced the prices quite dramatically, but as such, is not an evidence of dumping.
A lot of our listeners will be wondering, how can the Chinese produce these products so much cheaper than their European counterparts? Is it just they're better at it? And how significant is that difference in price in terms of what they can actually produce at?
The price difference with Chinese imported panels in Europe is quite significant and grew over the last year. It used to be around 20-30%. Now we're talking more around 50% and more. Why is that? Well, China has decided to invest in this strategic sector. So they have chosen and prioritized industrial policy on this sector and have been able to scale their production lines to the level that they have now and providing high quality products at a much lower price.
That is good, though, for the consumer, isn't it? There's nothing wrong if China can produce products more cheaply than Europeans can. That's just the way that the market operates. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
Well, it's certainly true that the quality panels from China at that price have helped solar being competitive vis-a-vis other more polluting fossil energy sources. We cannot be naive. We have to think about the geopolitics of the energy transition. So Europe does need to think about diversification and resilience. We cannot just have ourselves dependent on one single source of supply. So yes, we need to keep the borders open with China, but yes, we also need to invest in resilience. That's the difference between de-risking and decoupling. What Europe needs to do is to de-risk its relationship with China.
What does that mean then? Is it about putting more tariffs on Chinese products to lower the gap when it comes to price? What would you like to see?
We will certainly not like to see tariffs and imports from China. Then you move into an escalation of a trade war that Europe will not be able to win. Solar already had tariffs on imports 10 years ago. The only thing it did was to slow down the market and did not help European solar manufacturing. So there's other policies that Europe is actually putting in place right now, mostly by leveraging public procurement. So whenever you do a public auction for renewables or public procurements on rooftop solar, you choose European products first.
Let's see if that happens. There's been long talks today between President Xi and President Macron. What have they achieved? Here's Elvia Fabbri once again.
I guess the attempt of Xi was to avoid excessive high tariffs and trying to influence Emmanuel Macron to use his own leverage on the president of the European Commission.
Could that work? Because President Macron is quite clear that he doesn't want the EU just to follow the path that the US is taking to make its own decisions.
Emmanuel Macron has been the first advocate for strategic autonomy of the EU, not only control of foreign subsidies, but also reciprocity in public procurement. I think he's really supporting all those new investigations that the European Commission is launching. So I don't think that Emmanuel Macron would tend to change position on that issue and trying to get more opening of the Chinese markets. And that's where President Xi has been making some, I wouldn't call it commitments, but some declarations, trying to signal that he would be willing to open more the Chinese markets, obviously, to foreign investment, European investments.
If those tariffs come into place, then China will respond. We've already seen them threaten cognac, haven't they? The very well-known French alcohol product with possible tariffs there in retaliation. This could lead to a trade war, couldn't it?
I think that the Europeans are not well aware that they need to stand firm and that those new tools are there to protect the single market, to protect the European businesses. The tariffs that will be imposed on the Chinese EVs is as much an economic issue as a political issue. It's all about trying to gain more opening in the Chinese markets. So it's rather an offensive attitude. We're entering into turbulent waters at the moment. That's where tonight, maybe, the conclusion of the meeting have raised some eyebrow because the tone was rather on a cooperative approach and it was really the objective of Xi to try to move from the corner of being a systemic rival to a partner. And it's rather a moment when the EU should stand firm.
Let's bring in Peter Jankowskis, who was listening to Elvia there, Vice President, Research and Analysis, Arbel Financial Services, Chicago. We're talking about two of the great trading partners, the EU and China. The US has similar concerns, doesn't it, as the EU does, about China selling very cheap products in its markets.
Yes, it certainly has a devastating effect on local production in those areas. And there is a desire to maintain multiple sources of production. They've already, here in the U.S., instituted some of the measures that were talked about in terms of requiring domestic sourcing for infrastructure projects, et cetera. We're waiting to see if that will be enough. I suspect it will not. We're likely to see, I think, additional tariffs as we move down the line.
It looks like we're heading to some sort of greater trade problems between these big trading partners. Peter, stay with us because we want to get your thoughts on this story as well. There's more misery for the airplane maker Boeing, with the U.S. Federal Aviation Authority announcing yet another investigation into the safety of its jets. Our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, has been looking into this story. I asked her what this latest investigation is focusing on.
So America's air safety regulator has confirmed that they have opened an investigation. And this is the result of something that Boeing itself came forward and said, which was that they discovered some employees had falsified test results, claiming that they had been completed when in fact they hadn't. And that this came to light as a result of an employee in South Carolina at Boeing who saw something on the production line they just felt wasn't right, and essentially reported it to their higher-ups. And when Boeing looked into it, they discovered that indeed several employees had committed misconduct, claiming that tests involving kind of inspections of where bonding and grounding, where the wings join the main body of the plane, that actually those tests hadn't been carried out. Now, just to quickly explain, bonding and grounding, pretty crucial on a plane. It prevents static buildup. It's a bit like an electrical safeguard. So it's a kind of an additional check. And Boeing has come forward and said that there is no immediate safety or flight issue. But obviously, this is a huge concern, and the FAA has opened an investigation.
How damaging is this to a company that is already facing severe security concerns? We had whistleblowers, didn't we, recently, appearing in front of senior U.S. politicians, outlining the safety problems that the company has.
I mean, I think you've got it right on the head there. It's very concerning at a time, as you say, when safety issues keep coming up, quality control issues keep coming up, and there seems to be a problem with the culture of corners being cut. I mean, I think all of us can sort of identify with the idea of you cut a corner at work maybe sometimes. We've all done it at odd times in our lives. But, you know, this keeps coming up at Boeing, to such an extent that there have been safety issues with the planes, that there have been congressional hearings held, that there have been whistleblowers coming forward saying they have felt pressured at work and not been heard when they have tried to raise these issues. And so you've got management on the one hand stepping down, leaving the company, saying things are changing, but then you keep getting news like this. And it just shows kind of the steep mountain Boeing has to climb to kind of not only change the culture within, but also then convince the flying public and also its customers, the airlines, that things really have changed.
Yeah, you're talking about Mr. Calhoun there, who is stepping down at the end of the year. Whoever comes in to take his job running this company, it's not an easy one, is it?
It's not. And I mean, Mr. Calhoun, the CEO, as you said, has said he will leave at the end of the year. And that in part is to allow for a transition to find a replacement. But also, you know, leaving much more immediately was the head of Boeing's commercial division, because there have been huge problems with the 737. Remember, there was those bolts missing on sort of a door that came off an Alaska Airlines plane. And so he's already left. And you can't have all of management walking out the door at the same time. So they're kind of trying to stagger the departures to take accountability. And that's what they're trying to do. But the problem is they've still, it seems, got kind of some bad headlines and bad problems to still work out before they can kind of say this is behind them.
Peter, Michelle there, there are huge problems that Boeing faces. But let's be clear here. When it comes to buying planes, there are only two options, aren't there? Airbus, the biggest manufacturer at the moment, and Boeing. So in spite of the problems, those buying planes have got nowhere else to go.
That's true. There really aren't any alternatives. I'll also say that there is some sign that the culture is changing, given that this was Boeing reporting on a whistleblower that had come forward. So they are listening to their employees internally now, and that hopefully will help them resolve this issue quickly with the FIA.
Yep, let us see what happens there. Let's stay on the transport theme, which really has been a big part of the programs, and return to that issue of electric vehicles. Because a study by the global consultancy firm Wood Mackenzie says global petrol demand growth could halve in 2024. Christoph Ruhl is from the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University in New York. And he's been telling me exactly why we may see that slowdown in the growth of petrol demand.
There's two different but related things. So if you concentrate on petrol demand, there is these relentless and regular efficiency improvements, which we observe for a long time, which account for the lion's share of any sort of slowdown or in the future, perhaps decline in demand. And number two is, of course, the introduction of electric vehicles, and here in particular, the Chinese market, where China has established itself as a leader in that market, it's fair to say. Every second electric vehicle, counting everything pure electrics and also plug-in hybrids, is coming from China now. And that, in the longer term, is another serious prospect, but has so far not made really a dent into demand.
Can we talk about that China situation? One has to have some skepticism, don't we, about Chinese figures sometimes. Yeah. But is this also a government policy to try and move away from a reliance on oil? Because clearly they don't have their own oil, or not that much of it.
Yes, I think it's very important to be clear about this. There are all these doubts which you mentioned, that a lot of cars driving around, probably hybrids, with their charger cable never unpacked. You know? And all these things, numbers are dubious, storage numbers are not officially published, and so on and so forth. But there should be little doubt that China has put huge efforts into that market and made big progress for two reasons. One is what you said, is the desire to minimize oil imports. China is the biggest oil importer in the world right now and is one of the few countries where oil demand is still growing. There's also another reason, which is industrial policy. China has a long history of trying to focus its economic development into industrialization, first heavy industry, then increasingly light industry, and exports. And they have run the course of events, and they have been accused of distorting markets and subsidizing the exports and all of that. And rather than now doing the next step, as other economies have done before them, which is to switch into sophisticated services, financial services, all of these kind of things, they try to stick to industrialization and industrial policy. And they do that by betting on the energy transition, on battery technology, on solar panels. And electric vehicles are a big chunk in that platform. And that is, of course, something which is now, we encounter a slight irony, because those countries which talk most about promoting EVs, like the US and Europe, are the ones who are afraid of this Chinese competition. And rightly so, because China is cheaper in producing these vehicles.
We have been talking on the program quite a lot about subsidies and dumping because of President Xi's visit to Europe and France in particular on Monday. Can I talk to you about other parts of the world, though? Because whilst we might see a fall off in demand for petrol vehicles in China, could that be offset by growth for them in countries like India, Indonesia, parts of Africa as well?
Yes, this is precisely what is happening right now. And of course, there is this debate on whether these developments could go the way of, you know, the mobile phones, or where you have the old fixed line phones in developing countries being leapfrogged, as the term is, so that they jump from zero to mobile phones, whether this could also be done with the introduction of cars, that you don't have the big step of gasoline cars in between and you jump right to a car fleet, which is electric vehicles. The jury on that one is still out, but the evidence which we have so far is indeed that oil demand continues to grow, not only in transport, but also in transport on the back of increasing introduction of cars, trucks, lorries, but also, you know, just general commercial traffic, which is not electric.
What I thought was interesting in that, Peter, Christoph's analysis is that many parts of the world are in completely different positions when it comes to electric vehicles.
Yes, indeed. You know, some of them are, just as he indicated, developing personal transport, so it's fairly straightforward for them to switch to. It's harder for firms, or rather for countries, that have established transportation systems.
Very much so. You're listening to World Business Report here on the BBC.
The plane started to shake a little bit, something that alerted us that there was something not right.
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
Deep down inside you, you do have courage. You mightn't feel you've got courage. You mightn't feel that you're brave or resilient, but it's there waiting, just waiting to help you get through bad times.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
World Service. Let us move on to a story that we've been covering here across the World Service for the last 24 hours. The Israeli government is shutting down the operations of the broadcaster Al Jazeera in Israel because it says the channel is a security risk. Al Jazeera called the claims a dangerous and a ridiculous lie. I've been speaking to Alice Anders, Director of Research at Media Experts Anders Analysis, about what impact the shutdown could have on Al Jazeera's business operations.
This is a wartime situation, I think. But from a business perspective, obviously, the market of Israel is probably nil for Al Jazeera. But the point is, it, you know, interferes with journalism and how difficult it is to cover war. And we know that there are many really brave journalists that have tried and, you know, failed because, of course, the Israeli government's very intent upon controlling the narrative.
The Israeli government have said quite clearly that they think Al Jazeera pose a threat to national security. I wonder if we flip this on its head then. Al Jazeera, popular in many parts of the Muslim world, when a country like Israel takes action against them, could it lead to more advertisers in those parts of the world? Is it almost a statement of support?
Well, I doubt that. You know, the fact is that advertising isn't like an accordion that expands and so on. You know, Al Jazeera is a very well-established, very long-standing network, which treats each market separately from an advertising point of view. And, you know, each their linguistic variants, you know, there's the English language one, but then there are a number of different linguistic variants. So, you know, it has to tailor you know, very much, you know, in terms of each market having a specific advertising footprint where it's probably already very well represented with its coverage.
Can I talk to you about the news business in general? Because
sure.
It seems to me that this is a challenge that many news businesses are facing now, not just in terms of Israel, but in other parts of the world where governments, as you said before, may want to control the narrative. Is this an increasing problem?
Do you know, we are suffering, I'm afraid to say, from the most perilous time that I can recall, you know, and being a person of some age, I'm saying this goes back quite a long way. We have, you know, Russia's war in Ukraine. That is a huge matter for those of us who live in Europe and all the states that are involved and all the shifts to the geopolitical order and so on, not to speak of the U.S. election and so on. But both these conflicts are becoming embedded and entrenched. And it, I think it fills everyone with a lot of gloom.
News is a business, isn't it? A lot of these are privately funded organizations, not government funded organizations like the BBC is to some extent. Does this make it more complicated for them, more difficult for them economically?
Well, they are commercial channels. They have very well-established advertisers. They have wonderful audiences. They all watch a lot of TV, and they're all very premium audiences that have a lot of money to spend, at least in many parts of the Middle East. So I think the business aspect, I think it takes, you know, every business, there are a lot of businesses that are run by people who believe in journalism, who believe that is part of their vocation as business people. But you're absolutely right. News is a business, especially when you have journalists, you have camera crews, and you're actually trying to cover a war that's ongoing. There are danger factors and so on. It's a much more expensive operation, not to speak of the fact that nobody wants to see one of their employees lose their life.
Alice Enders there on that Al Jazeera story, of course, continuing coverage of what's happening in Gaza across the BBC World Service. Now, residents of a remote island off the coast of Northern Ireland say they're relieved that their only local store has been saved from closure. Organisers of the community-run outlet were shocked when nearly $15,000 suddenly disappeared. The funds were returned a day after the BBC contacted the shop's bank over its predicament. The BBC's Elaine Mitchell has sent us this report from Rathlin Island.
The island's shop is a busy place. It's a meeting point of sorts for Rathlin's 150 residents. It caters too to the tourists who'll be flocking here over the coming months. But at the shop, there's been one big talking point, because the shop's been the victim of a fraud and came very close to closing down after £12,000 was stolen from its bank accounts.
We got notification from the bank that standard order of £11,900 had been approved and left our account, which pretty much left nothing in the account at that time.
That's Rory Morgan. He's the chairperson of the community cooperative on Rathlin, and he's been dealing with the fallout of the theft.
The process of working with the bank took its toll. Like, I mean, it was 40 plus hours on the phone just trying to get a resolution to this, even though they were able to tell us that they knew it wasn't us that logged in. I'd been paying for some stuff from when I needed to work out what I'm owed and back on track.
But this shop is more than just a business. It's also a social hub.
People meet up here in the mornings and pass the gossip around or whatever it's going. And you know what I mean? It's a place where people like to meet up and catch up on one another. And this is important that we have the shop here.
It's about more than just the groceries.
It is. It's a bit, it's part of the community.
I'm meant to get my basics, my bread and my milk and maybe something nice for tonight when I'm sitting watching TV.
This shop is a bit of a staple on Rathlin. How important is it?
Oh, it's extremely important. If we don't have a shop, you know, you can't run to the mainland every day to get your basics, what you need.
I think everybody's now aware of how easy these scams can happen. Like, I mean, we're not immune to what's happening in the rest of the world here on Rathlin.
And for Aoife Molloy, it's been her workplace and it's the job that's keeping her on Rathlin Island.
It's a bit scary. I mean, obviously it's scary for me because I'm thinking, oh, it's my job and my wage, and we employ two other people as well. So it's, you know, it could potentially be three jobs that were lost. We'll have volunteers and staff that come just for the summer months to work in the manor house or in the bird sanctuary. So I'm very lucky to have a job all year round, which gives me a wage and enables me to stay here.
To everybody's relief, after 37 days, the shop has had its money returned. The cooperative bank said that they fell prey to a common type of scam. And there's relief all around that Rathlin's shop is here to stay.
That is good news, isn't it? And what a good way to end this particular edition of World Business Report.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.